Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Good morning. Good evening. Wherever you may be, here we are.
Whatever time zone you're in.
Whatever time zone you're in. Here we are for another live episode of the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast talking about a movie.
A movie. Tonight is movie night.
I love movie night.
I do too. I like this movie.
This was a great movie.
Oof.
So tonight we're going to talk about The Experimenter. The Experimenter, yes.
And the next thing I'm going to do when all my kids are together is I'm going to make them watch this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, because I'm going to talk to them about this.
I think this would be a great film to show in a psychology, intro to psych class.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Absolutely.
So we're going to talk about it. We chose this first movie. What was the other movie we did?
Inside Out.
Mm-hmm. which was great. Really enjoyed talking about that movie. But we chose this movie because this is a truly... A true psychological film, because it's really talking about, like, it's not the psychological thriller that you get sometimes with movies, but this is truly about psychological principles.
It's true.
Right.
First of all, it's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
And it is truly a movie about psychology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. This would be great in any psychology class.
Absolutely.
This is a story about one of the great experiments.
Yes.
In our field.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this film is all about the work and life and everything of Stanley Milgram.
Right.
And he was a research social experiment. He was an experimental psychologist, but he was a sort of a social psychologist, experimental social psychologist.
Yeah, I've always considered him an experimental psychologist.
Yeah.
I don't know why he keeps talking about himself as a social science researcher or something
like that.
But yes, it's classic experimental psychology.
Yeah.
The kind of which we can no longer do.
Right. Yeah. Right. And we're going to get into that a little bit.
Get into that.
So, where should we start? I mean, there's so many places to start. Let's get a slide up.
Start with, this is silent when the movie first starts, you don't think your sound is on.
That's right.
And it's very disconcerting. So it puts you in a certain frame of mind because you're convinced that your computer or your TV volume is not working.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Because it comes on and several minutes go by before there's any sound.
Yes, and it opens up to the experiment. And so his experiment was, it was really an ingenious experiment. Let's be honest.
I mean, it was fabulous.
Yeah.
It was unbelievably clever.
And we're going to get into some of the details about it, because I think that those details are just fantastic that he thought about all of that. But, you know, I want to start out with this quote, because, you know, this was 1961 at Yale University.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when he was first starting these experiments. And I love how, again, it opens up and you're sort of in the experiment.
Right.
And you have these two subjects walking in, and Mr. Williams introduces himself. And I love as he's talking about, you know, the
Mr.
idea.
Mr. Williams was the sort of the
research assistant.
Research assistant.
But he doesn't come across as the research assistant. Mm-hmm. He comes across as the researcher.
Right.
And there are some significant, important differences that we'll talk about maybe in a little bit, but... He starts out and he's talking about the importance of learning,
right,
and the importance of reward and punish and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I love this line, mm-hmm, that he says. He says, "Punishment is a powerful incentive toward learning."
Right.
For example, when a parent spanks a child.
Okay, right.
However, in fact, we actually know very little about the effect of punishment on learning because almost no scientific studies have been done on it on humans. Human beings.
So that was in 1961 or 62.
Yes.
Okay. What do you think of that today?
Well, there's a couple things that I think about with this. Because it's so fascinating. Because, first of all, we can pull this statement apart because there's some really important, right, pieces to it. You know, punishment is a powerful learning in some situations. We overuse it, but in some situations it is powerful learning. For example, rats learn very quickly what they should eat and shouldn't eat based upon a punishment that they receive if they eat something wrong. Yeah. They get sick, their stomach upsets, they will never eat that food again. Mm-hmm. That happens to us. That happens to humans. It's single trial learning.
Anything you've eaten and then had a case of the flu.
Right.
You don't crave.
You will not eat that again.
Touching a hot stove.
Right.
You know, getting a sunburn. Anything that happens to you like that.
Now, you might be sitting there thinking, well, those aren't punishments. Because nobody applied a punishment to you for doing those things. And that's where some of the important stuff comes out from this experiment. That, well, we're not talking about punishment as applied by someone. We're talking about the psychological definition of punishment, which is a consequence that decreases the likelihood that a behavior will happen again.
But that's not what they're talking about here.
Not yet, but we'll kind of...
Because when he introduces this, because I was struck by the same thing, that this word punishment, which we've talked about before, he's talking about punishment as an aversive consequence.
Right.
And you will learn... The experiment was, will your learning improve if we apply an aversive consequence?
Right. Yeah.
So this is punishment like spanking.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's not punishment as in, I want to reduce your behavior.
Right.
Because in this experiment,
exactly,
I want to increase your behavior.
So what this is really called, what this would really be called, is negative reinforcement. Right?
No. You're applying a shock. So it'd be positive reinforcement.
With the likelihood...
That you're learning will improve.
With the likelihood of decreasing the wrong answer. It's complicated.
No, it's... Your learning will improve if I give you an aversive... If your learning improves, you're reinforcing it.
Right. That's why I said it's a reinforcement.
It's reinforcement.
Right, I said it's negative
But they're talking about punishment as... We commonly use the word.
Right.
The people say, well, I'm going to punish you. That means I'm going to do some aversive thing to you to prevent, in hopes that I can stop you from doing this again.
Right.
So they're talking about applying an aversive consequence to see if learning will improve.
It doesn't fit in...
and it's already contradictory.
It doesn't fit neatly into the reward-punish paradigm that we typically think of, because it's not... Because I was wrong. It's not a negative reinforcement. Mm-hmm. Because negative reinforcement means that you're taking away something negative to increase the likelihood. So negative reinforcement would be if you're sitting in timeout appropriately, I'm going to take that away to increase the likelihood that you'll continue to behave appropriately.
Right.
And it's not a punishment because you're not trying to decrease the behavior unless you want to argue that we're decreasing... the likelihood that you will answer wrong.
And again, when we go back to, is he a psychologist or a social?
Right.
He's not wedded to the behaviorist paradigm.
Right.
So he wasn't obligated in any way to use that approach.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he wasn't concerned. So he's using punishment as we typically, in the common parlance of punishment.
Exactly. And I think, though we kind of... It got a little muddled there.
Yeah.
I think that was the main point that we want to start off with, is that throughout this film, they talk about punishment and that he's torturing people and that he's doing these things. But we're using the word punishment, and it is different. It is sort of a common definition of the word punishment as opposed to a scientific or psychological meaning of the word punishment.
Right.
It's and there is a difference. There's an important difference there because when we talk about effectiveness of a punishment, then it varies. There is some variability there, so it's very confusing and it's very tough to follow sometimes. But there's something else that was in this quote. I'm gonna see if I can pull it up again here. There's something else that was in this quote that I thought was fascinating, and that is, he says, the last line there, almost no scientific studies have been done on it on human beings.
Right. That's right.
Because we have done this They have done this with rats.
Tons of studies on rats and mice and dogs and monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Because what they're doing is that we've done studies to show and to explore the effects of negative stimuli and positive stimuli on learning rates. And, you know, they do this with mazes when it comes to rats and things like that. And so it is a fascinating history series of studies that have looked at, you know, the effects of learning from punishments and adverse and positive experiences.
Right. Right. But very little on humans.
Very little.
Especially
humans.
At this point, because Skinner had done most of these studies. He actually started to do them in the late 30s and early 40s. And he was well ensconced at Harvard by this time. So he was carrying out these learning experiments in rats and pigeons and mice and other animals, mainly rats and pigeons. Yeah. So he was well on his way in the 60s. Because he had done most of that research in the 50s.
Right. So. Yeah, and so it's, of course, I think we always try to point out that a lot of Skinner's work was with animals. Most of his work was with animals.
That's right.
And he generalized it to humans, because we don't know, he never put a human in a Skinner box, for example. Skinner box were the little things that he put the rats in.
But it's hard to do his research with humans because one of the things that Skinner did was he had highly motivated subjects.
Right.
And they were motivated because they were hungry.
Uh-huh.
And you can't do that with humans.
Right.
It's very difficult to have a laboratory setting and it's very difficult to assure that your subject is motivated.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you can make sure that a pigeon or a rat is motivated simply by decreasing their body weight to 80% of ideal
body mass. Reduce their body weight by 20%. Mm-hmm. So you're halfway to starvation.
Right. And so you're starving.
But you're very hungry.
So you don't do just about anything for food.
Do anything to get food.
Yeah.
Right. But we can't do that with
not even in
humans.
The 30s. No. Could you really do that? Mm-hmm. It's getting close. It's getting close. But that brings us to another point that was I think that they did a real nice job in this film to demonstrate, and that was a lot of Stanley's motivation. You know, he talked a lot about, you know, the mistreatment of the Jewish community during World War II by Hitler, and he seemed to suggest that a lot of his inspiration came from just not understanding how people, some of the German soldiers, could be so cruel to people. And then say, you know, I was just following orders, I was just doing what they told me to do, because that certainly is what his research found.
That's right, because he's Jewish, and his parents came from Eastern Europe.
Right.
And early in the film, he says it was just luck that his parents ended up in the United States, because the rest of his family was lost in the Holocaust.
Right.
Okay, all those Eastern European Jews were exterminated, and his family was part of that extermination.
Right.
So he has a very personal interest in how do you get people to perform these acts of cruelty?
Right.
And is it, were Germans somehow exceptional?
Right.
Or was a subset of Germans exceptional? Mm-hmm. Or is this part of human nature?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, so he had a very personal interest. And this is going to come up later in the film. I've forgotten the character's name, but we'll get there as we go along. Mm-hmm. Because they talk about the ethics of this study.
Right.
And I'm going to make a point about that as we go through.
Yeah.
But yes, he had a personal, and his wife, he eventually gets married. And his wife is also Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And her family also was involved. And so he does have this passionate interest in this topic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Noreen wrote in and said that she thought that the monotone nature of the narrator was punishment for us, because how the narrator was very monotone throughout.
Oh, I like, but
but what I thought was fascinating about that is that, you know, he was never excitable, even when he was being confronted. When Stanley was being confronted, I'm thinking back to the time when he was talking to Abe
Lincoln mm-hmm. in the street.
Yeah.
And that woman came up and she was kind of being confrontational
poking
with him.
In the eye with and, a stick.
You know, he had some snippy responses, but he never raised his voice. He never really got agitated or angry or anything like that. And he stayed pretty
I want to say, thing. Which is typical of academicians. Everything true. Is done at a very intellectual level.
All There's of them no that I know.
Passion. And that's what was different about Milgram is that he had a passionate personal mm-hmm. interest in this topic right. because of his family history.
Yeah. So the so let's talk a little bit about some important factors that came about from his what he just kept referring to as the obedience experiments, because
mm-hmm.
right. there were some really important things that came out of these studies.
Right.
The first thing is, you know, when you watched as the experiment was unfolding, mm-hmm. You see the learner who was a plant.
Right.
You know, we mm-hmm. know that now. We didn't know that, you know, when you first watched the film.
And the experimenters didn't know that.
Right.
Right.
The participant didn't know that. So the learner is the plant, and he leaves his hat mm-hmm. in the chair next to where the
right.
The teacher will be sitting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I was in a class, I would say, "So, why do you think that he did that?" And I think that his motivation for that, the sort of the detail of something like that, was that he wants to make sure that the teacher knows that that person is real. Sometimes when somebody is out of our sight, you know, this is something that's learned early in our mm-hmm. in our cognitive development, the idea that something exists even if you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But many times, especially when we're talking about these types of issues, if the person is not sitting in front of you, if you can't see them, then you don't really know that they're
mm-hmm.
real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for many of you who watch this film, especially millennials who haven't watched this film, that may be a bit of a strange concept, that because the need to be reminded that the person on the other end is not real, because we talk on telephones much more than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
We Snapchat and we Instagram mm-hmm. and we message and we do all these things with social mm-hmm. media with somebody else that we never see or that we don't see for hours and hours. At that time, in the early 1960s,
right.
you know, people didn't use the phone like we do now. And we didn't interact with people the way that we do now. And so I think that that may have been a detail that they left in as a homage to, look, at that time, mm-hmm. we needed a reminder that that person was a real person.
That's right, because they couldn't, the teacher was behind a dark screen and couldn't see the learner.
Right.
They were hearing things, but they couldn't see anything.
Right.
And you forget, and it's in several of the experiments, the learner was silent.
Right.
And it would have been very easy to forget that there's a person
right.
over there. By leaving his hat,
right.
he left his presence.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was still there. So when we're talking about social learning theory, that's something that's really important. That's an important mm-hmm. component, because you have to have that other person's presence, at least.
It has to be a real
right.
person.
It has
right.
to be a real person. So now, something else
yeah.
was showing the equipment.
Right.
You know, they did it, and you know, part of me wants to say that the antiquity of the equipment played with it, but of course that was probably, you know,
state of the art.
State of the art.
It was state of the art in 1960s. I said, "Wow, where'd they get that equipment?"
Wow,
they had to get a grant to get
it. Thousands
now you
of
get
dollars.
A high school student to build it.
But it's it was really important that they walk them through it, told
right.
them what each thing meant, what mm-hmm. it did, and
right.
and all that, and then walked into the other room and showed the mm-hmm. student being, you know, having the electrode,
right.
the
mm-hmm.
the couple put on his arm,
mm-hmm.
walking them through that. Each step of that makes it more and more real.
Makes it more real.
Right. And that was the goal, right, was to make it more and more real. And I think they did a really good job with that.
They did. And you're always aware of this equipment.
Right.
You're always aware of the technology.
Yeah.
You know, it's there all the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And even the sound.
Right.
That the buzz sound, mm-hmm, that the equipment made when he was applying the shock.
Right.
Was great.
Right.
Because that, again, is,
yeah,
that
it could have been
presence.
It could have been just a flick of the switch and,
right,
the person couldn't hear it, but you're hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're well aware that it's being delivered.
Exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, what about the learner saying, I have a slight heart condition?
Right. I thought that was absolutely classic. And again, that's Milgram.
Yes. That was a detail that I think a lot of researchers would have
left out. Right. They wouldn't have thought to do it. He just thought about everything.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I have a heart condition. You're going to start shocking me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're like, there's no tissue damage.
Right.
And then, of
yes,
course, the test subjects sample shock. So
right,
when they give... And one of the... Well, it's not a secret in psychological research or anything by any means,
right,
but it certainly is the case that when... In doing research, when we're trying to figure out, what a person knows, what a person understands, right, we may expose them to something,
mm-hmm,
and ask them to estimate for us,
right,
what level it was,
right,
what whether it's strong, weak,
mm-hmm,
what voltage, that kind of thing. And so that's what they did with them. I think that no matter what the person said, he would have the test subject is almost guaranteed to say something much greater than 45.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it didn't matter what they said because,
mm-mm,
it's always going to be higher than 45.
Right. Right.
And so, again, that subtle,
mm-hmm,
detail of, right, making sure that they know that was only 45.
Mm-hmm.
That's our starting point.
Right.
We're going to get up to 90, 300.
450.
We're going to get up to 10 times that amount.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, 450 is 10 times what you just felt.
Right.
Anybody doing the math.
To someone who has
heart,
a heart condition.
Has a heart condition.
We're
going to
give a guy with a heart condition,
right,
an electric shock.
10 times what you just felt.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see how they would respond. And the... So what this experiment was really aiming for is to figure out if people, sort of to what extreme people would go to in harming someone else, someone that they don't know, someone that they have no connection to,
mm-hmm,
how far and how much harm will they do to that person simply because they're told to do so.
Right.
Now,
mm-hmm,
if we remember at the beginning of the experiment, the research assistant tells them, here's your money, you've got your money, it's yours to keep, no matter what happens from here. You can leave at any time. I think he even says that very directly.
Mm-hmm.
You can leave at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And so just because as it progresses, the research assistant says, nope, the experiment says you must continue.
Right.
Most people continue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what does it say that most people continue?
I don't know. I know this experiment because we've talked about it. We
yeah.
talk about it in our classes so often. We teach it. We talk mm-hmm. about it. We've learned it. I've watched this film. I still don't know.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that I would be like the Dutchman.
Yeah.
And just say no.
I like the one woman who turned the machine
yes.
off.
Right.
I think he goes, did you just turn the machine off? She's like, well, you
yes.
know, yeah.
Yeah.
And then she goes to do the next one. He goes, make sure you turn it back on.
Right.
So.
He uses a term, agentic. Agentic.
Uh-huh.
Which is the state, if an authority figure tells you to do something, it will override your personal morals and
right.
your personal ethics.
Right.
And I just don't know. And it was hard for me. It was... throughout the entire movie, I kept thinking, what was the motivation for the teacher to keep on with the experiment? They weren't
right.
getting anything for it. Now,
right.
they had been paid, okay?
Right.
And perhaps they felt some obligation to complete it.
Right.
At
one point, one of the subjects said, I thought that this the research relied on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think that they that, felt that like they had an obligation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And whose responsibility is it?
Right.
You know, that question keeps coming up again. But I was sitting there thinking, they're not getting a grade for, they're not students,
right.
So they don't have to perform. The man in the gray mm-hmm. lab coat had no real authority over them.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't an employer or anything. Mm-hmm. So it was hard for me to imagine what kept the teacher going. They didn't have to. I mean, they were told they could walk out at any time.
Which was really the purpose of the study.
That's the brilliance of it, I think, because he set it up so that they could walk out, and mm-hmm. they kept taking orders.
And they just wouldn't walk out.
And you're going to talk about Eichmann. At some point, we're going to talk about Eichmann, and that the juxtaposition of this experiment and mm-hmm. that trial,
mm-hmm.
it's almost more than coincidence.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Well, you know what? Let's go ahead and talk about it now, because I don't think I have a specific slide for it. But he was one of the mentors of...
Who? Eichmann?
Yeah.
He was the architect.
Right, right. And so, but his studies were a little bit different, right?
Wait a minute. Are you talking about Ash with the lines?
Right. Oh, no, you're talking about...
Okay. Yeah, you're talking about Ash.
Right.
His advisor. Ash. Right.
Yes, okay. Yes.
You're talking about the other psychologist.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Ash did the sort of the peer pressure study, where the people were sitting at the table.
That was a fascinating study.
Again, we were talking about this earlier.
It was so simple, mm-hmm. but so elegant.
We were talking about it earlier, how it's amazing how there's these periods of time where people, where it's just this right time where these important mm-hmm. studies are done sort of in series.
Right.
And there are studies that just change things. But that was the Ash's study was the look at peer pressure. And so you have five people sitting there and
right.
only one of them is the research subject.
Right. Right.
And they all give wrong answers. And when it gets to the research subject, what does that research subject do? Do they go with what they know is correct, or do they go with the crowd?
And at one point, he looks at the others like,
he's like,
what? You know, it's so obvious that they're wrong,
right?
You know, and he knows that they're wrong, but he goes with the crowd.
He does. And what's fascinating is as I watch that and I think about those studies, I think of some of our patients, like patients mm-hmm. with Asperger's or autism mm-hmm. spectrum. They're not going to go with the crowd because they don't succumb to those types
True.
Of social pressures.
True.
And so they're going to be like, are you guys stupid? Can't you see that? Of course it's not that one. It's number right. one, not number two.
Yeah, they don't have the social skills to
That's
go
right.
along with the crowd.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's that need for social conformity
right.
that Ash really started to point out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but Eichmann's was different. Talk about Eichmann's a little bit.
Well, this study was done in 1962. It was published right. in 1962. And that was the same year that Adolf Eichmann was arrested. He was discovered
mm-hmm.
Living in South America. And the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, captured him, brought him back for trial. And there's a great story, The Man in the Glass Booth. There's
right.
a story written about him. But he was the architect of the... of the industrialization of extermination.
Right.
And to the end, continued to argue that I was just following orders.
Right.
And all through the Nuremberg trials, which were conducted just after the war, that was what the Nazis who were accused of these crimes, war crimes and extermination, they kept arguing that they
right.
were simply following orders. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my responsibility. I was simply following orders.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's fascinating because, and again, I think that this is the idea behind it is a lot of what drove Stanley to do these
and that's
studies.
Why he was, that's right.
And then, of course, mm-hmm. when he comes out and you know those trials happen, and then he basically says exactly the same thing that his research studies finding.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of. I think would be a lot of validation for your research findings,
right.
but at the same time, it remains completely baffling.
And we look at the Holocaust today, and we all ask the same question, how could this have happened? And that's the simple question. That's the question that Milgram was asking then. How could this have happened? And the brilliance of this experiment is that he discovered, well, it's very simple. You simply tell somebody to do it, and they do what they're told. That's all it takes.
That's all it takes.
The Holocaust has replicated itself since the 1940s. I mean, we keep seeing the same thing occurring. So not a unique event in history.
No.
The scale was different, but the event is not.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one more point on this slide.
In fact, he says,
although painful, no permanent tissue damage. You know, he's just reassuring that, you know, it's going to be okay.
It's going to hurt.
It's going to hurt, yeah.
But it's not going to damage anything.
No, it'll be fine. The person will be just fine. So, but again, that's important because what they're basically saying is, go ahead and keep going. I know he's complaining about it, but he's not going to be permanently damaged.
Right. And at that point, you know, you keep saying, I'm not sure that I could continue, but they did. Almost all of them did. Virtually all of them.
Right. And I love the first person. Noreen mentioned him in the notes here. The first guy that really said no was that electrical engineer, and he's like, "Hey, look, I've been shocked before," and so and that introduces an interesting little twist to it because, you know, he knew what he could relate, empathize with the test subject more than anybody else.
Right.
And so he says no because he knows what it feels like.
He knew what that would do. He knew intellectually, cognitively, what that amount of electricity would do to a person. The others obviously didn't.
Right.
As an engineer, he did. And he said, I'm not going to do that to anybody.
Right. And he had experienced
shock
himself.
But he's the outlier.
Right. He was the outlier.
He was the single outlier.
Right.
Because he knew the technology. But, ooh.
Yeah. But, it's fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, there was this line in the movie.
This was one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
I'm really interested in what you think about this line. He says, life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards.
Right.
I've been waiting all day to hear what you
Why?
I don't know. I just wanted to know what you...
I just loved the scene where the delivery guy...
Yeah.
was able to quote the line. Is it from Nietzsche or Kierkegaard? I can't remember. But it's a famous philosophical quote. You know, you have to live moving forward, but you understand everything
when you're looking
with
back.
Hindsight. Mm-hmm. You know, but you live your life moving forward.
Right, but while it's a great quote, it's a great statement.
Right,
we don't often appreciate it. We don't often abide by it because we continue to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Right.
And I think, you know, we're going to ask the question in just a little bit, you know, should these studies have been done? And I think that what'd you say?
I'll say it in a minute. Go ahead.
It's been a long day.
No.
It has been a long day, though.
We understand. You remember the line when he said, "We can study human nature, but we can't escape it."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we study all this stuff by looking back at what people are doing, but people are going to keep making.
Right.
It's predictable to Milgram that people are going to make these same decisions in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because perhaps his research studies suggest that because some of this stuff is just part of human nature.
It is part of human nature.
It's just part of what we do.
This should not surprise us.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So when we're talking about living back, or we understand it looking backwards, we are talking about retrospect, and we're talking about, and I think that it's a line that I think I'd like to use in treatment sometimes, in treatment with my patients sometimes, because I was just talking with a fellow today. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, you know, the past and how, you know, challenging the past few years have been, and how challenging different portions of our life have been. And we think of them as miserable. We think of them as lousy. We think of them as just really bad and negative.
Right.
But at the same time, we learn so much from those experiences. And sometimes those experiences make us stronger and more competent and more able than any other thing in our life. Any of the successes, we oftentimes grow more during those more difficult times. But for some reason, instead of looking back and trying to gain that from those experiences, we just sort of put them aside into a box and say, no, that was a really bad time in my life. I don't want to even think about
it. And we can look back and understand our past, but does it inform our future?
Right.
You know, that becomes the question.
Right.
You know, do we learn anything from our mistakes?
Right. So you have, so for example, you're in a really bad relationship that just is unhealthy. It's abusive. It's all of the negative things that you can think about with the relationship. You finally get out of that relationship and you're thinking, I never want to think about that again. You don't want to dwell on it, certainly, but you also want to look back at it and say, okay, what signs did I miss at the beginning of that relationship so that I can look for those signs the next time and not fall into that trap again?
What am I missing? Or the person who gets married, essentially marries the same person three times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So life is lived forwards.
We want to live forwards, but we want to look back and learn what we can learn.
Right.
So, all right. So now we're going to kind of get into some other things here. I think. So social relations. Social relations is fascinating. You know, something that, now that I'm looking at our slides and stuff, I'm noticing something that we didn't do. And we didn't talk about the film itself. We're talking a lot about the psychological stuff in it, which is great. But I'm going to take this slide off for just a second, because I want to see your reaction to this.
I'm going to shake my head in disbelief.
No.
For starters.
It's good stuff.
No.
All right. So what was his studies all about? Learning. So how many times did an elephant walk through the scene?
Twice.
Right? When he's walking down the hall, there's an elephant walking behind him and he goes from door to door. It's fantastic. The subtleties of the subconscious implications, the implying...
What did you think about when you saw that elephant?
I thought it's memory.
Memory.
You know, because elephants have good memories.
Right.
So, you know, they put that in the background. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching it, you're not really thinking about some of those things. You're thinking, oh my God, it's one of those artsy.
No, that was. What about Abraham Lincoln?
Abraham Lincoln, Honest Abe.
Honest, right?
Yeah,
I'm honest.
But okay, so we can keep picking this apart because it's gonna be great. How about the fact that he had a British accent?
Who? Abraham Lincoln?
Uh huh. He wasn't quite what he seemed.
He wasn't quite what he seemed.
Yep.
He wasn't the real.
Right.
He wasn't being honest.
Right. So we have all these...
But the woman was.
Right.
She was being very direct and very honest.
Very honest.
And Abe is fake.
Yep.
It's a fake Abe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Great stuff.
So there were... Yes, little things like that.
Little things
pop up
hidden.
In the movie. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the message.
Yeah. It's just hidden throughout the whole thing.
I want to see that slide.
Okay. Yeah, we'll go back.
Social relations.
Sorry.
Because that was his field.
I just wanted to make sure we mentioned that, because I thought that was great.
The film was loaded with that kind of stuff.
Great details, yeah.
The scene where they're standing at the window and his friend tells him, I'm getting a divorce.
Right.
And there's these long pauses, and then he said, I'm sorry to hear that. Long pause. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not discussing it.
Right.
You know, just thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great stuff. So social relations is a blanket term. But, I mean, basically, we're just talking about interactions between a couple people, different people. All right. So it's not a complex concept until you really start thinking about it. And then it's like, oh, well, I suppose it is pretty complex, because we're talking about not just verbal interactions. We're not just talking about nonverbal interactions. We're talking about physical interactions. Mm-hmm. We're talking about all of these little details. If you notice during the experiments, as Milgram is taking notes, he's noting all kinds of things.
Right.
Pushes his fist into the table, looks back, takes a heavy sigh. He's noting all these things that the person is doing, maybe even somewhat subconsciously.
Right.
Because of the discomfort, because of their disappointment with their own actions, perhaps. But he's taking note of all of these things that they're doing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because all of that is part of social interactions, right. Social relations.
Right. And I also like this concept of assuming one's role.
Absolutely.
Because when the teacher is put in that position, they suddenly, we don't know what these people did.
Right.
I guess one was an attorney and one was an electrical engineer. That's
right.
All we know.
Right.
We don't know what the other people did for a living. But whatever role it was, as soon as they took on the role of a teacher, they began to act
perform
a certain
like
way
a
and perform like a teacher.
Right.
Okay? And it made me think of, I can't remember the word now, but in the concentration camps,
right.
They would appoint prisoners as assistant guards.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a name for it. But it was sort of, you got extra food and you got it. And so here were Jews persecuting other Jews
right.
because of the role that they were given by the Nazis.
Right.
Yeah. So you play these roles.
Right. And we know that this is the case. You know, when we were figuring out which movie we wanted to review, we came up with two. And it was between this one and that newer release of the... about the Stanford prison trials,
right.
prison experiment.
Right.
That one's available on Netflix as well. And we chose not to do that one, though that study, that movie, depicts
the same
sort of social dynamic
right.
that when you are assigned a role, you take on the characteristics of that role, even if you know that it's not a real situation.
Right.
And for those of you who don't know, the Stanford prison experiment, they took students, some of friends,
right.
and they divided them randomly
right.
into guards and prisoners,
and
they made them stay at the university in one of the basements over the weekend. I think it was just over the weekend.
Yeah, weekend.
And they started out as friends, but you know the guards had to be the guards and the prisoners had to be the prisoners and. There was no, you know, there was no abuse or anything like that really indicated. But man, the guards started abusing the prisoners.
Right.
Even though they were friends.
Right.
Because they started taking on those roles.
Right. Lord of the Flies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. So the teachers in this one, you know, there was that scene where the research subject almost started yelling at the at the student.
Right.
Stop, concentrate, and trying to get him refocused and reoriented to the task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty poignant because they really did get into the role.
Yeah,
you know, when he started yelling at him, I thought, man, this guy's turning into a teacher,
right?
A certain kind of teacher,
right?
But a teacher nonetheless,
right?
Yeah.
And then we get to the point that you brought up a minute ago, and that is, whose responsibility is all this anyways?
Right. And that question keeps coming up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because is it the person who tells them what to do? Is it that person? Is it the researcher's responsibility? I think to some extent, that is where Milgram really took a lot of criticism. He got a lot of criticism because... They talk about him putting people in these situations where they believe that they are abusing someone,
right?
And they were really, they say that they were concerned about people being psychologically damaged by harming other people and doing all that kind of stuff. So they have made the argument, and since these experiments were done, people have been very critical of Milgram for these studies. And the way that he went about them.
That's right. There were articles published recently within the last couple of years that are still debating and discussing this research.
Right, right. Now, the other side of that, though, is it the responsibility of the teacher, the person in the experimentee in this study?
Right.
Is it that person's responsibility to say, as the electrical engineer did, and say, no, I'm not going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And And certainly there's the argument for that.
And recent court cases mm-hmm. are suggesting that you are never absolved of responsibility.
Right.
So I think that from Nuremberg on, and much of our ethical code is based on Nuremberg trial.
Right.
Okay. And the Nuremberg trials established this notion that you have personal responsibility and you can't appeal to authority. You have personal responsibility.
Right.
It doesn't matter what else is going on. And that has permeated, and it's one of the things we teach our students and teachers, is that it has permeated the ethical codes of physicians as well as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you... I don't care what anybody else does. You have a responsibility to report.
Right.
And so it's built into our legal system now.
Absolutely.
But I love the conclusion.
Right.
Nobody will take... I don't know.
Right.
The conclusion is, when they ask the fundamental question of whose responsibility is it, the answer is clearly, I don't know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe one way to interpret that is... it's all of ours. It's everybody's
responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility.
Yeah, right. It's not just one person's. It's mm-hmm. everybody's. So, we already talked about Milgram's initial motivation for the studies, mm-hmm. but let's talk for a moment about the fact that another outcome of the study is really that people just really have a difficult time thinking for themselves.
That came through three times
mm-hmm.
in his study on obedience.
Uh-huh.
And the second one was when the line or the line
right.
length.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it. And the other right. one where people would look up at the sky,
right?
And other people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one woman is even taking pictures of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't anything there,
right?
And she gets her little phone and her iPhone
camera
and takes a picture of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's three times where people mm-hmm. clearly. The message is we don't think for ourselves,
right? Mm-hmm. And it's. You know, whether we want to call that peer pressure or we want to call that, we just want to call it assimilation or conforming.
Mob
mentality.
Mentality or emotional plague. You know, one author
right.
calls it emotional plague where you just get whipped into this frenzy mm-hmm. and you do things that you wouldn't normally do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever we want to call it.
A lynch mob is,
yeah.
you know.
Whatever we want to call it, what it comes down to is that people aren't thinking independently. They're
right.
thinking with the group, for the group, mm-hmm. in the same way as others in the group. And this is how things get escalated. Very, very easily things
right.
get escalated. Because when we talk about mob mentalities, mobs don't typically start out as mobs.
Right.
Mobs typically start out as a couple people being upset, and then there's a couple more people. And when you have a couple more people that get upset, mm-hmm. the upset is increased in,
right.
in intensity
mm-hmm.
And in scope, and then it just continues as the quote-unquote mob continues.
Right. And if we go back to Nazi Germany, which is what this is essentially about, when we talk about the mob, there were many, many people in Germany who were fervent supporters of Hitler.
Right.
Not just the inner circle, but large percentage of the population, especially in the 30s,
right.
Very supportive mm-hmm. of Hitler and his policies and what he was doing. And those who weren't were either eliminated
mm-hmm.
through killings,
right.
mass killings, or they remained silent.
Right.
And we have that whole notion of, you know, I didn't speak up when
right.
I could have. And so we are cowed into
right.
Acquiescence. We're afraid to say anything.
Right.
You know, the whole notion of I don't want to ask a question in class because I don't want to seem stupid.
Right.
You know, there again, it's another manifestation
right.
of the same thing.
Yeah.
But this whole notion of staying silent in the face of inequity, inequality,
right.
Pain and suffering.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's get down to the main controversy here.
What?
The main controversy is, were these studies
oh.
ethical, and what about the ethics of not doing the studies? You know, were the studies worth it really? And this is in a minute that you had me on pins and needles for. What did you want to? I'll tell you what I think first. All right. I don't know that. I think that these studies are in that are in somewhat of a gray area from my perspective. I think that they're in somewhat of a gray area when it comes to ethics. Now, the reason I say that is because we know that we can do studies. We're going to talk about, for the for those psychology nerds out there that want to really get into some of the stuff that we like, the sort of the details about us, about such a study. But before we get into that, I think that there are lots of times, lots of situations where we have to have blinded studies where the research subject does not know the true intent and true purpose of the study. This right. would be one of those situations where, as he said in the movie, I'm going to have these research participants come in and say, hey, I want to see what you're going to do to how much you will hurt somebody, but you're not really hurting them, but I'm going to try to make you think that you're that kind of study is never going to work. Mm-hmm. So from an ethical perspective, I think that it's in a gray area because they are potentially doing harm to someone, but there were clear opportunities, and participants were given clear instructions that they could exit the study anytime that they wanted to.
That's right.
Your thoughts?
Number one, it's an important question. Mm-hmm. If it was a frivolous question.
The research question.
The research question
right,
is
right.
What causes people to... Remember, we had just finished one of the mass exterminations of our species.
Right.
Okay, with the Holocaust. Okay.
Right.
And Stalin was doing worse.
Right.
In Russia at the same time.
Right.
So what... Is this part of human nature?
Right.
Or was this an anomaly?
Because people were really asking that question. What could lead someone to do this?
What caused it? How
right.
could this have happened?
Right.
I mean, that's everybody in the world was saying, how could this have happened? When Eisenhower and the generals went into the concentration camps, they were so appalled that they brought film crews in to say, nobody will believe this.
Right.
Nobody will believe what we're seeing. That's how astonished the soldiers were when they went into those camps. And so Eisenhower insisted on filming everything. So the entire world was asking this question. So it is an important question.
Right.
Now, does an important question mean that you can be unethical? No. But then the next question is, was he being unethical?
Right.
I say no.
No.
Number one, he told people that they could leave whenever they wanted.
Right.
Okay, which is one of the things we have to assure when we do research. Second, he wasn't really causing harm.
Right.
They may have thought they were causing harm, but that, after all, was the experiment.
Right.
Third, he told them after the experiment that they didn't do any harm.
Mm-hmm.
So that they didn't walk out of the experiment thinking, my God, what kind of person am I? They were debriefed
right.
before they left the study area. Okay?
Yeah.
And so I think given those protections, I don't think it was unethical.
Right. Now there was one scene in the film that pushed me into the gray area.
Okay.
Because I didn't tell you why I was in the gray area.
Right.
I just told you why I wasn't a no.
I was surprised that you said you were in the gray area.
The reason I was in the gray area is there was one scene, and I remember this because I have a little bit of post-traumatic stress from dealing with the IRB myself when I was at the university. Remember the scene where he's getting in his car to go home to eat, and one of the previous research subjects came up, and he said, I went home and I was talking to my wife about it, and you know, she's just really troubled about that I would do that. And one of the things that we have to address when we do IRB is we inform the research participants of any possible psychological harm that could befall them.
Right.
And while they did do a debriefing, the debriefing did not protect that person from that ongoing psychological harm.
True.
And so that's what pushed me in the gray area. They couldn't have predicted that necessarily.
Right, right.
Maybe they could have.
Right.
I don't know how they could have worked around it, except unless they maybe did some type of psychological testing of the subjects before the study. But that is what pushed me in the gray area.
Yeah, I wonder if they anticipated what harm it might do to the
right.
to the teacher. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a good point.
Right. Because they weren't harming the student, but we didn't think about the psychological harm that it was could potentially do to the teacher.
And we see that when the three women were interviewed.
Right.
They were obviously troubled.
They were angry.
They were troubled by this thing.
Yeah. But did you notice that? The one woman in the end, she's in the TV or the Netflix show, Orange is the New Black.
Right.
She says, don't lie to me. Just don't lie. You can lie to them. You can lie to everybody else, right. but don't lie to me.
Don't lie to me.
So wait a minute. Why is it okay to lie?
Why
is there evil, but I can't lie to you?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, my question was, what about the ethics of not doing the study?
Yeah.
Because you remember the scene where they were sitting in his living room and there was another gentleman in there and they were drinking brandy
right.
out of the brandy snippers mm-hmm. and he kept urging him, you have to keep doing this. He wanted him to go to Europe and
do
it in Germany, do it in France. He was encouraging him to do it because he obviously suffered
right.
during the Holocaust.
Right.
He was Jewish and probably his family was exterminated. And he said, you must do this.
Right.
Okay, you must bring this question. We have to answer this question. We owe it to our civilization to answer, to ask these questions and to try to answer them.
Right.
So what if he had never done this study?
Yeah. I think that's I think that that's what drives research.
Right.
What drives research, because research is a sort of a cyclical, follows a cyclical pattern. It's not linear at all. And so every study that we do raises new questions that we explore with subsequent
right.
studies.
Right.
And so I think that that's what drives researchers day in and day out.
And we're going to talk a little bit. Are you going to go to the next
mm-hmm.
topic?
Yeah.
Because there's something else that I wanted to make sure we covered, and I think it's in
Are
this.
You ready that we, for us to go to the next topic?
I am. But
okay. Well, you know what? I clicked the wrong button, so I took us off the off the screen share. So let's go to the next slide here. Our conclusions. Our conclusions, while you're looking to figure out the specific one you want to talk mm-hmm. about, is the idea that we will obey.
Right.
You know, and thinking about aggregated data, so putting all of the data together,
mm-hmm.
we will obey.
Right.
And since we will obey,
mm-hmm.
we're prone to comply with what we're told to do, even if it's against our own moral code, even if it's mm-hmm. against our own beliefs and our own ethics,
mm-hmm.
we are likely, there is a strong probability that mm-hmm. we will obey.
And it doesn't take much of an incentive.
Right.
No, we're not. Imagine if you were forced to do it. Imagine
right.
if you were paid large amounts of money to do it. This was with almost no incentive.
Right.
People did it.
If you were at risk for it to be done to you if you didn't do it to others.
That's right. Do it or I'll kill you.
Right.
You know, that's an easy one. Because there was no incentive here.
Right, okay. right. We talked about
people
this one already, that
themselves.
People don't think for themselves. But what about the next one? The state will override the person.
He talks about that, and he uses the word agentic, and it must have been a word he created. I'd never seen that word before.
Yeah.
He talks about it's an agentic, because the state will, if you're expected to do it, it
mm-hmm.
will override your personal ethics.
Right.
That clearly was the case with most genocides.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter where they occurred. Once the state said to do, I mean, look at what's happening in Syria. Those are Syrians against Syrians.
Right.
They're killing their own people. Civil war in our country. The war between the states in our country.
Right.
You know, Americans killing Americans because you were told to.
Right.
You know, that slaughter that 600,000 mm-hmm. people died.
Yeah.
So it will. The state will override it. And that's a scary mm-hmm. thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Hunger Games.
Yeah.
You know,
hey, that was a great...
Another example of the state.
Yes.
The 100.
Yeah, the 100.
The 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as we said here, we really don't... In those situations, people really don't care about the victims. They're not really thinking about the victims. They're thinking about obligations are, what their...
That's the scariest part of
expectations
this.
Expectations are.
Is that you don't even have to hate your victims, like you said with the Stanford prison.
Right.
Right. You didn't even have to dislike your victims.
Right.
Imagine if you disliked them, how easy it would be if you
right.
depersonalized and turned them into an enemy.
Right. You know? And what do we think about with that in recent time, in more recent times? We think about in Guantanamo Bay,
right?
What we saw the, some of the guards do
with
to
Abu Ghraib,
right?
Yeah,
So
and this demonization of other people,
yeah,
you know, is so frightening, especially when the state does it,
right?
You know, if you have your the political establishment is demonizing another group for some reason.
You're trying to get into politics.
Again. No, I'm going to leave it right there.
All right.
And just let it roll around and do whatever you want to do. Obligation, I really like.
Yeah.
You know, whose obligation is it? Where,
right.
Where's the ethics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So now for those of you who sort of like some of the research stuff, I think I think it's great.
We're not going to. Are we really going to do this?
Just for 2 seconds.
Hold. I want all of you to hold them to it.
Okay. These are the main points from the research design.
All right. Nobody cares.
The setting was great. I like how he kept changing the setting.
The setting was perfect.
He did it laboratory. He did it in an apartment or a hotel room. Did it outdoors. You know, some of those experiments are outdoors. And it replicated it. It repeated. That's the nature of research. That's what we have to do with research. Some folks try to question research and say, well, why do you keep doing the same thing over and over again? This is why.
Right.
We want to make sure, as he said in the film, that we wanted to take it outside of the laboratory because that may... I love the fact that it was even so specific that they had a gray lab coat. Not a white lab coat because that would be too
clinical.
Too clinical.
Right.
We wanted to have a gray lab coat.
Maybe too obedient, you know, because you're used to the white coat being in charge.
Right.
So they put him in a gray coat, which took away that variable.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the doctor talking.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you notice, Noreen mentioned earlier about the monotone nature of the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
What that really demonstrated is the consistency and the rote nature of the researcher. He did not emote in anything that he said, because if you emote just a little bit, you're going to influence, and you're going to guide your research participant in a direction that he or she may not have otherwise gone.
Right.
And so that consistency that you see, the Mr. Williams, he says the same thing over and over and over again, in pretty much the same way. And I think it's a beautiful design for that.
Right. And that's what you need. And it reminded me of 2001, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dave, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's the way Mr. Williams was.
Right.
Sorry,
right.
You have to continue.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The experience.
So it doesn't take a lot of poking and prodding. It just takes a little bit of insistence.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have to do that with our tests. We have to be very rote in our tests.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, of course, we talked about the ethics, the idea of participant deception.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of times in research where it is important that we have participant deception.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, but the IRB and the protection of participants have gotten so strong that there's a lot of studies that we just can't do anymore.
We can't do them anymore.
This study would not be approved anymore, I don't think.
That one wouldn't. I don't think any of his. The Stanford wouldn't. No.
Stanford.
No. Well, the only one would have been Lyne.
The Lyne one.
Lyne judgment would be.
The looking up.
Maybe.
The looking up outside would be. Could
that
be.
Would be.
But certainly the one where they think that they're harming someone, that would never be approved.
No. The IRB, I did a study years ago on genetics.
Right.
And it took me 18 months to get the IRB approval for that because people are frightened of genetic studies.
Right.
You know, rightfully so.
Right.
But it's very difficult, and you would never, anytime there's deception involved, you have to be exceedingly careful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's so frustrating.
When you're a researcher, it's frustrating.
As the researchers.
There's so many good studies that we could do if we could have some minor deception, but we're just not permitted to do it.
Right. It's just there's so many, it's so restricted, and it's amazing what things get through the IRB really quickly and what things are held up and stopped and halted right away. So
I'm glad we have institutional, we're using the term IRB, that stands for Institutional
Review Board.
Mm-hmm. Every university and college has an institutional review board to review studies to make sure they're ethical.
Right. Okay. And there's some private companies that do it.
Companies do it as well. Yeah. So now we have this controversy.
Yeah.
And as recently as a couple of years ago, there was an article in the Atlantic Monthly that was highly critical of this.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the criticism, the ongoing criticism? I think...
I was wondering why you wrote that word down earlier.
You know, people criticize Milgram died of a heart attack at, what, 51?
Yeah, 52. He was young.
Yeah. People who are criticizing now, I think two things are happening. The critics today are looking at this through a different lens.
Right.
This was not in 1960, notice all the people smoking cigarettes.
Right.
Things have changed.
Yeah, how about when he went in to debrief with the one guy and he starts smoking a cigarette, he offered Stanley a cigarette, and he goes, no, thank you.
Yeah, because everybody smoked.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch Mad Men,
yeah,
you know, it's the same thing. They drink and smoke in their offices. It's a very different perspective that we have today. So for somebody to look back and criticize him from today's perspective is a little unfair because there are significant changes that have occurred since the 60s.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, you and I have been in academics.
Yes.
And we know what happens when somebody becomes famous.
Yes.
In our midst.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that person has become famous in our midst.
And we know that there is something called petty jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
And this man rose. First of all, he was at Harvard and Yale and NYU and those kind of places. And this is not a gentle sport.
Right.
And reputation is everything because these are the people at those places are vying for Nobel Prizes, for the top positions in the world.
Right.
Okay. So the stakes are very, very high. And if you sense that somebody's getting ahead of you, they're not always charitable about that.
Right.
And I think much of the criticism was petty jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't academic. It was petty jealousy.
Yeah.
Because he did become very famous very quickly.
He did.
He was really young when he did this. And I think part of the criticism at the time was petty jealousy.
Yeah.
I mean, there were careers at stake.
Yeah. You know?
And tenure and all those important decisions.
All kinds of things, yeah.
So I'm not sure that the criticism is deserved, whether it was then or today.
Yeah.
I just think it's a brilliant, elegant series of studies that he did.
Well, I agree.
Wish I would have thought of it.
I do too.
Man. Of course, I was young in 1962.
Yeah. I don't know how to respond to that.
I know what you're thinking.
I'm thinking a lot of things.
I wasn't born.
Yeah, that's right.
My parents were young.
My mom was in middle school, I think. maybe not yet, maybe.
He just can't. You know, we...
So, all right. Wait, I think we have one more slide. So
you do?
I think so.
I didn't,
because,
mean, to, I didn't mean to step on the slide.
No. You know what the last slide is?
What?
The next slide is next week.
Is next week. Is it next week or next month?
Next month, sorry.
Okay.
I wish it was next week.
I got work to do, man.
Yeah. Next month, we are going to do this again. I really dig this. I really like
doing
movie reviews.
You know, you've asked me many times, have you seen that movie?
And
you...
Here's the opportunity.
The answer's no.
Always no.
It's always no.
Always no.
So this is catching me up on movies.
That's right.
This is good.
We were talking about what movie we're going to do next. And he's like mentioning movies from... You mentioned good movies.
Is this on air? Are we visible right now?
Are we? I don't know.
Okay.
But... I put together a list of
a
like
viewing list
20 movies or so that we could choose from, and
I've seen most of it.
You've seen the list. So he chose The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Now I can't wait for us to talk about this. This is great.
Everything I've heard about it.
Yeah, because you haven't seen it yet.
I have not seen this movie. I understand that I should.
Yes,
it has one of our favorite little characters in it.
Hermione.
Hermione is in this movie.
Emma Watson is in it. This is a fantastic movie.
I'm surprised how many movies she's made.
And unlike The Experimenter, which, you know, today's film really just let us talk a lot about psychology. But human nature from some of the research that came out from in psychology. But this film, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, this is going to really let us dive into all kinds of things, because this is a, I wouldn't say this is a psychological film per se. It's not about psychology per se, but there are a lot of things,
a lot of principles in there.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
This is gonna be fantastic.
Good.
So
somebody
next
made a comment.
August 17th.
Can you believe that it's...
I know, it's crazy.
I mean, oh man.
August 17th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It'll still be daylight time then, yeah? Eastern Daylight Time.
Oh, yeah.
We will be talking about The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Mm-hmm.
We'll post the link to the show as soon as Google Hangouts lets me do that.
It's too far ahead.
It must be too far ahead for it to let me have the link.
Where life is lived forwards.
Yes, but it's wanting to look us, hold us back.
Right.
So that's going to be August 17th, Thursday, mm-hmm. August 17th at 6:30 p.m. We're going to do The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Looking forward to it. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. And we've enjoyed the interactions that we've had. Noreen is writing to us, and she's roasting you just a little bit.
Oh,
Twitter twinge.
Let me hear.
See what's great
Come
about
on,
it is that he can't see the. What?
Go ahead.
Yeah. She just said.
She said
you did a really good job.
I did.
Yeah. So
Noreen,
that is it for today. Richard, it's getting late, and I'm. Are you tired? It's been a long day.
No, I mean, why should we be tired?
We should go home and watch The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Okay.
I think I have it on DVD. You can borrow it.
Is it on Netflix or Hulu?
It's not on Netflix. I don't know about Hulu. I don't have Hulu.
Guess what?
What?
I was going to watch The Experimenter again last night.
Uh-huh.
But everybody was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to work I don't know how to work anything in my house, so I don't know how to get on Netflix or Hulu or Apple TV. I bought all that stuff, but I don't know how to use it. And usually somebody's in the house, and I can say, "Hey, Gabby, would you turn this on?" But I was alone, and I couldn't access it.
I can't hold it in.
Noreen, hold it in, Noreen.
All right, Noreen wants to know what BF stands for BF Skinner.
Burrus, B-U-R-R...
U-S?
U-S or I-S?
Mm-hmm.
U-I-S. B-U-R-R-I-S. Frederick.
Burrus Frederick Skinner.
Yeah, B-U-R-R-I-S. Frederick Skinner.
I would go by B-F as well. B-F Skinner. So, all right. I think that's all for today. Is that it?
We could continue, but we'll stop here. We'll be back.
Yeah, we'll be back. Well, we'll be back
tomorrow
with regular podcasts.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
But please, if you have any questions or comments, let us know.
Right. That's right. Hey, actually, you guys will love the podcast that's going to come out. Well, if you're listening to this on Friday when it's posted, which tomorrow when it's posted,
mm-hmm.
the next one is Saturday, and that's our interview with Lee Wilkinson. No mm-hmm. relation, but we talk all about autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
So
it's interesting guy. Yeah.
So, all right, that is it for today. Time to go home. You guys have a great evening, and we'll see you next time. So until then, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.